It's the 30th of September 2011, and you're listening to The Pod Delusion, a podcast about interesting things. I'm James O'Malley. Coming up this week, we answer the questions. Why isn't physicist Lawrence Krauss upset at the lack of Higgs boson? Are the godless BBC engaged in a conspiracy to wipe Jesus off the calendar? Was the Pope's trip to Germany a success or a West failure? Is spontaneous human combustion real, or has that theory gone up in smoke? And do teachers need a lesson in teaching? But first, are neutrinos guilty of breaking the laws of physics? We start this week with double physics. Don't worry, there's not going to be a test afterwards. In the last week, the very fabric of space-time itself was potentially ripped into pieces and weaved into a noose for the theory of special relativity to hang itself. In other words, neutrinos that can travel faster than the speed of light were alleged to have been discovered. This is big news because fundamental particles have never so recklessly broken the rules before, and yet days later we're still waiting for the moderate particles like sugar and sand to come out and condemn the actions of their fundamentalist colleagues. To find out more, Kash Farouk has been speaking to physicist Ben Still to find out whether everything we learned in school is now essentially useless.
Last week, a sensational announcement was made by neutrino researchers at the Oscillation Project with a Motion Tracking Apparatus experiment, i.e. the OPERA experiment. They think they have detected neutrinos that have broken nature's speed limit, the speed of light. I caught up with particle physicist Dr. Ben Still to talk about this. Ben's field of expertise is the neutrino. You may remember my episode 70 Pod Delusion report in which I described Ben's encounter with a so-called neutrino skeptic. I started with the obvious question, what is a neutrino and why are they important?
So the neutrinos are one of the very few fundamental building blocks of nature, which we call the fundamental particles. So if you took nature and split it down until you could divide it up no more, you'd find that there's a very small subset of building blocks, and these are the fundamental particles, and the neutrinos are part of this set. We think they're very important because we believe that they hold the key to a chapter in the creation story of the universe. So as we know it in physics today, when we turn energy into mass using Einstein's equation in particle physics experiments all around the world, we always create equal amounts of the normal stuff around us, which we call matter, but also equal amounts of a mirror version, which is called antimatter. And this would be a problem if this happened in the universe at a perfect level, a perfect symmetry, if you like, perfect balance. Because when matter and antimatter meet again, as they inevitably do, because they're two opposites, then they form pure energy again. And if this was perfect, then the universe would be nothing but a warm bath of energy. In fact, it'd just be microwaves today. There wouldn't be any structure because there wouldn't be any raw materials to go into stars, which then go into planets. And we believe that the neutrino holds the key to this imbalance between matter and antimatter because there are other building blocks called quarks. And the imbalance between matter and antimatter has been measured by looking at these quarks. And it doesn't quite account for enough of the imbalance that we see that's gone into creating all of the raw material for the universe as we see it today. And so we hope, by understanding more about these neutrinos, that we can learn more about this crucial chapter in the creation story of the universe.
So you're involved with an experiment in Japan called T2K. Can you tell me about that, how it works and how you use it to study neutrinos?
Certainly. So, I mean, as I say, we need to really understand the neutrino so that we can start looking at this imbalance between matter and antimatter. And neutrinos are slippery customers. They're really ghostly. And so we're still at a stage where we're kind of pinning down their exact characteristics. And the neutrino sometimes exhibits a very bizarre phenomenon. It decides actually to change from one type of neutrino to another. So I mentioned that neutrinos are basic building blocks, and there are in fact three of them, and they correspond to three charged particles, the electron, which I'm sure you've all heard of, and the electron has two heavier cousins, one called the muon and one called the tau. And there are three neutrinos associated with these three charged particles. And what we do in T2K is we create a pure beam of muon type neutrinos, so just slightly heavier versions of the electron type neutrinos, and we fire them from the very east coast of Japan, 300 kilometers over to the west coast of Japan, and we look at them changing. And now we know that the majority of the muon neutrinos will change into the tau type of neutrino, so the heavier yet still type of electron. But what we're looking for in T2K for the first time is we're hoping to see muon-type neutrinos changing to electron type. And the reason we're interested in this is because this is the last type of this weird phenomena, this weird change, which we call neutrino oscillations. It's the last type that needs to be viewed before we can then start probing the difference between neutrinos and antineutrinos, that balance between matter and antimatter. And so, as I say, we create these neutrinos using a particle accelerator on the east coast of Japan, very much in the same way that nature creates neutrinos in the upper atmosphere. We accelerate protons to high energies and smash them into a still target, stationary target, much in the same way cosmic rays hit the upper atmosphere. And this creates showers of new particles called pions, which then rapidly decay into these muons, these heavy versions of the electron, plus the muon neutrinos. We stop all of the particles, apart from the neutrinos, which go sailing on 300 kilometers over to the west coast, where we look for some of them disappearing and hopefully turning into electron neutrinos.
And how does T2K compare to the OPERA experiment?
So the OPERA experiment is a little different to T2K in that it's using much higher energy neutrinos. And the reason they're using higher energy neutrinos is because they're hoping that if you give a neutrino enough energy, that they'll be able to produce this heaviest type of kind of a charged particle, the tau I was talking about. So you need a lot of energy. You need tens of GeV to be able to produce one of these taus because they're really huge, a lot heavier than the electron. But they are using the same sort of beam in that they have a pure muon neutrino beam that they're firing from CERN. And they are at a longer baseline. So I said at T2K we're firing from the east coast 300 kilometers to the west coast of Japan. The distance between CERN and the Grand Sasso Laboratory, where they're detecting the neutrinos, is actually over around 370 kilometers. So they're at a longer baseline. So there are subtle differences, but in the same way, it's essentially looking for these neutrino oscillations.
The announcement prompted lots of discussion on the internet. Why is it such a big deal? You know, can you tell us why this is so important?
I have to say, obviously, if the neutrinos are traveling faster than the speed of light, it does overturn pretty much most of our current theories of the universe. So it's quite a phenomenal statement, and it would require an almost entire rethink of a lot of the fundamentals of physics as we know it. And so, obviously, if this were proven, then it would totally overhaul physics, you know, as we know it right now. So that's why it's been made out to be such a big deal. So
you wrote a very quick blog post straight after the announcement, and that's been touted around on various, like The Guardian and The Telegraph have linked to it. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, sure. So really it was just talking to colleagues over coffee, and we were just, you know, banding about numbers, and Supernova 1987 came up, as it always does, because it's the first example of neutrino astronomy, so the first example of seeing things in our universe not using light, not using optical and other wavelengths of light. And so we were just thinking what this time difference would mean if we were observing the neutrinos from a supernova. I calculated that you would probably see, you would see the neutrinos around about 4 years, plus or minus about 1 year, before the light arrived on Earth. So what you would see essentially is 4 years before you even saw the supernova in the night sky, you'd get this ultra energetic, you know, an intense burst of neutrinos in your neutrino detectors. But what was seen actually at the time was the supernova 1987A was seen optically, and then people went back to these neutrino observatories, such as Kamiokande 2 and the IMB experiment, and said, okay, we saw this supernova in the night sky. Can you go back into your historical data and see if you saw anything in neutrinos? And they did see it, but it was only 3 hours before the optical signal of the supernova was seen. And so 3 hours is a lot less than the 4 years. And in fact, the 3 hours can be taken into account, because the light is actually slowed down when leaving the supernova through self-interaction, and that is what accounts for the neutrinos coming through faster than the light in that particular case.
Okay, and finally, physicist Jim Al-Khalili tweeted, if the OPERA experiment proves to be correct and neutrinos have broken the speed of light, I will eat my boxer shorts on live TV. So is there anything you can promise that you'll do?
I can promise to be there with him with a catch-up, and I'll eat my socks, to be quite honest. It is such an amazing claim that obviously skepticism is the first port of call. But there's something inside of me that obviously would love this to be true, because it does offer very many exciting opportunities for new physics. But at the same time, we need proof. We need independent review of the systematics, and we need independent results from other experiments.
Right, I think that's everything I wanted to ask. This is Kash Farooq talking to Dr. Ben Still for The Pod Illusion. Thank you for talking to me, Ben.
Okay, thank you very much for having me.
Staying with physics, and it was announced this week that Professor Lawrence Krauss is going to be in London in October giving a lecture for the School of Life on the topic of cosmic connections. He's an interesting bloke, having won a stack of awards, published tons of books, and he even advised the Obama campaign on scientific issues. So Liz Luckendorf sat down with him to find out what he'll be talking about when in London.
I seem to be slowly collecting interviews with eminent scientists and physicists, and this week is no different. I'm always rather trepidatious when approaching the CV of many of these interesting people, as they're rather impressive, and Professor Lawrence M. Krauss is no different. He's a theoretical physicist and foundation professor of the School of Earth and Space Exploration, and director of the Origins Project at the Arizona State University. He has written numerous books, including 2 new ones in less than a year. The first, Quantum Man, Richard Feynman's Life in Science, was released in March this year, while A Universe from Nothing, Why There Is Something Rather Than Nothing, will be released in February 2012. Luckily, like most of these individuals with their buckets of awards, degrees, books, and YouTube videos, they are rather nice and happy to chat about their work. Since Professor Krauss is coming to London, I first asked about the title of his talk, Cosmic Connections, and what kind of connections he's going to talk about.
Most of the people think, that the cosmos is removed from their own lives, and what I want to show people is that there's so many aspects of their daily lives that have direct connections to even the most esoteric things that we are talking about in science today. So we're really connected to the cosmos in a host of different ways that hopefully are unexpected and will cause people to sort of rethink their place in the cosmos. So that's the basic context, that the esoteric phenomena of physics are not removed, and they're not something that is of only of interest to people at the Large Hadron Collider and doesn't relate to anything in your daily life. In fact, everything in your daily life is directly connected to it.
Why do you think this is important, especially now, to make these connections?
Well, I think that there's a disconnect for many people between science and culture and their lives, their politics, the public policy. In every way, science is a central part of our lives. There's no escaping it, yet people tend to escape it. And so I think it's pretty important in the present time for people to realize that they're not disconnected from even the most remarkable research at the forefront of modern science, and that they can appreciate it and enjoy it as part of their life. It's not just a matter of the technology being there to make their lives better or more secure, or the financial impact, or building a better toaster. It's actually that even the more esoteric ideas are really a part of their lives. So the ideas right now, science and culture, are really strongly divorced. And I think it's more and more important, especially in the present time, all of the major challenges we face as a society in the 21st century will depend on science. And one way to get people to appreciate it more is to realize that it's relevant to their everyday lives.
And in March, you wrote a book on Richard Feynman, or a biography of Richard Feynman. Will he also perhaps make an appearance in your talk?
Oh, probably. It's hard to imagine he wouldn't. But you know, I think absolutely. I think that the integrity that science requires, the idea that the universe is the way it is, whether we like it or not, and that we have to force our beliefs to conform to the evidence of reality rather than the other way around, is a central part of the courage and integrity that made Feynman a great scientist. And it's really the other lesson I think that I want to leave people with, is that the, you know, people are fascinated by these myths and fairy tales like the Bible, and the real universe is so much more fascinating than any silly stories that humans have come up with, that we don't need the nonsense. The sense is actually fascinating enough.
By your schedule, you've probably been traveling quite a bit, but physics has been in the news a lot. One is the ever-present search for the Higgs boson. Are you worried about it? There's been some commentary about, is this going to disrupt our view of the Standard Model?
Well, I hope it'll disrupt our view of the Standard Model. One of the things that people don't realize, that if you're a scientist, the two favorite situations you can be in is one, confused, and two, wrong, because it means there's more to learn about the universe. And so it'd be a lot more interesting to be wrong than right, in a sense. And it would be surprising in some sense. It'd be remarkable if the ideas that we've developed over the last 40 years, in the absence yet of experimental confirmation, were exactly correct. I mean, it still could happen, but it would be remarkable. And so it's more, I generally find that every time you open a new window on the universe, you're surprised. And so I wouldn't be surprised to be surprised. On the other hand, I hope it's not, well, in some way, the most surprising discovery at CERN would be no discovery at all. And that would be, from a physics perspective, fascinating. But unfortunately, I believe from a sociological one, it would be devastating, because if the Large Hadron Collider doesn't see anything new, even though that would be fascinating because it would mean many of our ideas at the basis of the Standard Model are wrong, I think governments would be a little hesitant to spend money on the next machine. When we go up to them and say, guess what we discovered? And they say, what? And you say, absolutely nothing. It might surprise them, or at least disappoint them. So that's one thing. And I know the next question you're going to ask, but ask it anyway.
The neutrinos.
Yeah.
We've had some high-profile scientists here. I don't know if you know Jim Al-Khalili, but yeah, he's mentioned that he'll eat his shorts if the neutrino story turns out to be true.
I heard that. I don't think he... I think he was a little timid. It's just, it's really an embarrassment, actually, in my opinion. Experiments have anomalies all the time, and most of the time they go away. But even so, it's not inappropriate necessarily, if the experiment has an anomaly that they can't understand, to publish an event on it. But to have a press conference suggesting something that's so obviously nonsensical is really irresponsible in the present time when people don't have a filter. And I, you know, my inbox is full of people who are telling me, oh, yeah, their theory explains how things go faster than light. Well, the trouble is, it's not just an isolated fact. Things travel faster than light, and that's it. It's related to a whole symmetry of nature, which is a fundamental part of all of the theories that we work with, and that work so well that allow us to calculate things to 10 decimal places with great accuracy. Plus, the fact is that it's inconsistent with other results. 20 years ago, in fact, I wrote a paper showing that from a supernova, the fact that neutrinos and photons traveled 150,000 light years, therefore 150,000 years, and arrived at their detectors on Earth within 4 hours of each other, meaning they travel at the same speed to better than one part in a billion, which is four orders of magnitude smaller than the claimed effect. It's just silly, and it's embarrassing, and it's unfortunate for CERN, because, you know, if CERN doesn't discover something, the only thing people remember about it is its wrong discovery. It's kind of a disservice to the public, who, as I say, don't have a filter and see this stuff. And then when it turns out to be wrong, they lose faith in science. And so what we have to tell people is that there are lots of anomalous results. As we learn things, experiments come up with things, and often there are systematic uncertainties, and it takes a while to get things right. But to make these outrageous claims that then turn out to be wrong is a disservice to the public, and it also is a disservice to science, in my opinion.
I guess kind of leading on from that, when you have all these Republican presidential candidates doing, I guess what we can call anti-science, do you worry about the effect of that on the public, or do you think most of people will see through the more extreme of their claims?
No, they won't see through. That's the problem. I helped create an organization in 2008 called Science Debate 2008, which was designed to create a debate between the presidential candidates on issues of science and technology, because in fact, as I think I said before, every major issue facing the president and the public in the next few decades, every single issue has as its basis science and technology. So it would be important to have such a debate, not a debate, say, on faith, which is completely irrelevant. But we couldn't get one, although we got the candidates to both campaigns to at least answer 14 science questions about, you know, issues in science policy, which was the first time that happened. But now, as I just wrote in a piece, that it's more embarrassing because we couldn't have a science debate 2012 because one of the parties is basically an anti-science party right now. And the money that's spent trying to convince people of things that are just factually wrong has been very effective. At least 60% of the American public, and some surveys, 70% of the American public don't believe in human-induced climate change. And in the United States, of course, over 50% don't believe in evolution. So having candidates that spout this kind of nonsense that are openly willing to flaunt empirical evidence is of course, hugely of great concern, because that's the point. It's not that scientists should be making decisions, but it's the greatest threat to our democracy to have an uninformed public electing uninformed politicians, because if public policy isn't based on sound empirical evidence, then the public policy is nonsensical and we'll all suffer.
You were a science advisor to Obama's campaign. Do you think he's done all right on the science front in his first term?
Well, obviously I'm disappointed with many things that have happened, but he's facing this ridiculous situation. And you know, he's chosen really good people to work for him. I would have hoped that a lot more would have been done by now. But on the other hand, he's facing this group of crazies in Congress and a public and a perfect storm of economic misery combined with, you know, political nonsense that it's almost impossible to get anything done. So I guess I'm quite sympathetic. I think right now he's the only thing that's keeping the United States afloat, frankly.
To finish on a happier note, would you be able to tell us about your new book that is coming out in the new year?
It's not a book that's designed to tear down religion so much as to demonstrate the fact that it's irrelevant. And by doing so, to focus mostly on the positive aspects of what we know about the universe and how it is really strange. And once again, that it is stranger, the truth is stranger than the fiction that people insist on developing for themselves. And if they just let go and enjoyed reality, they might find it more satisfying and certainly would lead to a better world.
Well, that's a very positive note, so I think we'll end on that. But yes, thank you very much for agreeing to this interview, especially at the late hour.
Thank you.
If you'd like to go to the lecture, the organisers, the School of Life, have kindly offered Pod Delusion listeners a 2-for-1 discount. So even though he may be lecturing at the New College of the Humanities, you won't have to pay 18 grand to see him speak. You can find details of the lecture and the special offer on our website at poddelusion.co.uk. Now, one of the biggest, most important stories this week was rightly given front-page coverage on the Daily Mail and followed up by its numerous commentators, including Melanie Phillips. I'm not talking about the Eurozone, the Labour Party conference, or even the neutrinos, of course, but the fact that on a small subsection of the BBC website, they decided to use the Common Era dating system instead of AD and BC, that is to say, refer to BCE and CE instead. Needless to say, it's been a harrowing week. The bodies in the streets, the carnage, as the masses have run amok in outrage at this news. And that's why I'm presenting this week's show from my Daily Mail bunker, which shields me from the modern world outside and instead takes me back to the golden age of Britain during World War II, when there were no gays, immigrants or political correctness. In fact, the only problem back then was the constant risk of being bombed from the air or invaded by the Germans. Oh, what a wonderful, relaxing time that must have been. Incidentally, if you'd like to build your own Daily Mail bunker, all you'll need is some sheet metal, some incandescent and non-fluorescent light bulbs, and a hell of a lot of rose-tinted glass. They're quite cheap too if you can get someone Polish to build it. But anyway, to get to the bottom of this horrifying date story, here's Dave Cross with more.
BBC turns its back on Year of Our Lord. This was the Mail on Sunday's front page last weekend. It went on to say that 2,000 years of Christianity were being jettisoned for the politically correct term Common Era. The story claimed that the BBC had replaced the terms Before Christ and Anno Domini with Before Common Era and Common Era. In case you don't know, these terms are sometimes used in place of BC and AD. Although the actual dates are the same, These terms indicate that the years are counted from some mutually agreed point in time, rather than a religiously significant event. They've been in use in academic circles for about 150 years. Now, I'm not a Christian, so I don't really care which terms are used, but the Mail thought this was the most important story to share with its readers last weekend, which is strange, because the story just isn't true. But it's interesting to trace where this idea came from. I think it has its roots in Peter Hitchens' column in the previous Mail on Sunday. Hitchens had been watching University Challenge and noticed Jeremy Paxman used Common Era rather than AD. Hitchens described this as a nasty formulation designed to write Christianity out of our culture. This kind of dig is common in Mail columns. Their writers never miss a chance to point out how the BBC is undermining the British way of life. But that's almost certainly where the story would have ended had it not been for James Dellingpole. On Saturday he wrote a blog post for the Daily Mail entitled, How the BBC Fell for a Marxist Plot to Destroy Civilization from Within. I swear I'm not making this up. Dellingpole takes Hitchens' seed of an idea and spins it into a monstrous conspiracy theory where the BBC is doing all it can to bring down Western civilization. Where Hitchens talks of a single example of the BBC using Common Era, Dellingpole insists that this is a new BBC policy. From now on, he says, ironically, the BBC will use initials which strip our traditional Gregorian calendar of its offensive religious content. And he manages to find something that backs up his story. The BBC religion website largely uses BCE and CE because somebody in that department has decided that when you're talking about various religions, it's important not to give undue prominence to a single religion's beliefs. And Dellingpole finds a fact page on that site where they explain this policy. Reading the fact, it's clear that this only applies to one small part of the BBC's output, but Dellingpole ignores this and decides that it must be the policy for the entire organisation. These three items, Hitchens watching University Challenge, the BBC religion fact, and Dellingpole's conspiracy theory, then become the pillars on which Sunday's front page is built. The story takes Dellingpole's inventions as fact, and explains to the readers how the BBC is dropping the much-loved terms. Sustaining this theory is tricky, as the BBC's output contains very few examples of this change of policy, and plenty of counter-examples, but the writer ploughs on regardless. At the end of the article, he asks the BBC for comment, and gets an unequivocal reply. They tell him that there is no editorial guidance on the use of date systems, and that such decisions are left entirely up to the individual production teams. A lesser writer might have quietly dropped this inconvenient fact, but this writer knows that by putting it right at the end of the story, that means that only a tiny number of his readers will see it, so he includes it anyway. And he seems to have been proved right. There are 1,500 comments on this story on the Mail's website, and very few of them show any sign of having read beyond the first three or four paragraphs. Of course, once something appears on a Mail front page, it is effectively fact as far as most of the population are concerned. Over the next few days, the story is reprinted and expanded in various other publications. The Telegraph asks Boris Johnson to write a blog post about it. He says that the BBC are being puerile, absurd, and even anti-democratic. The Huffington Post republishes it without bothering to check the facts. And everywhere this story appears, the comments fill with people expressing total outrage at something that the BBC hasn't done. Plenty of people complain to the BBC. The BBC publishes a reply once again stating that the story is entirely untrue. This, of course, doesn't make it to the front page of the Mail, and therefore goes almost completely unnoticed. There's one more interesting point. Both Dellingpole's story and Sunday's front page version strongly imply that this is a recent change of policy at the BBC. I suppose they'd have to claim that, otherwise they would have difficulty explaining why there are so many examples of BC and AD throughout the BBC's output. But some people wondered how long the religion fact that the whole story hangs on had been in place. The Tabloid Watch blog contacted the BBC press office to find out. The answer they got was that this policy had been in place for over 4 years. So the story isn't even new news. So this is what we know. The BBC in general has no editorial policy on the use of BC or BCE. The BBC religion website prefers the BCE version and has done for at least 4 years. Over the last 10 days, various Mail writers have taken those facts and spun them into a story about the fall of Western civilization, and most of the people reading it have believed them. This is Dave Cross for the Pod Delusion.
The Pope has been visiting Germany this week, and there are some interesting echoes of when he visited Britain last year. Now, obviously, as a secularist and an opponent of many of the Pope's policies, it's within my interests to present him in a negative light. For example, in Sven Rudloff's report in a moment, he talks of how the Pope spoke in the German Parliament. You know who else spoke in the German Parliament? That's right, Hitler. Now, I'm not saying that David Starkey and the Pope are the same person, but have you ever seen them in the same room together? I certainly haven't. Actually, thinking about it, there's no evidence, too, that the Pope didn't ghostwrite Indiana Jones 4. I think Benedict has a lot to answer for. But to tell us more, here's Sven Rudloff.
News from Germany. Our Pope just paid us a visit. Well, when I say our Pope, it's not for religious reasons. Statistically, only about 30% of Germans are Roman Catholics. Another 30% are Protestants, 35% are not affiliated with any denomination, and the remaining 5% are mostly Muslims. And as always, the number of actual churchgoers is much smaller still. On Easter and Christmas, you may find about 5% of Germans in church, especially in the Catholic south and west of the country. The reason for the Pope's wider popularity in Germany is rather because he is German. Benedict is the first Pope from German territory since Clement II and Victor II back in the 11th century. So it's kind of a big thing, like your national team winning the World Cup, even if you, personally, are not really into football. Though I guess for the English listeners, it's probably the other way around. Anyway, the Pope just paid his fatherland a visit with a predictable mix of events. He held mass services to call for the unity of the Church. He met with members of the Jewish community, half-heartedly referring to the Church's role during the Holocaust. He met with representatives of the German Protestants, showing no real support for any cooperation. And he met with victims of sexual abuse by Catholic priests, but this meeting was not part of the formal agenda. Leading up to the Pope's visit, we had all the usual debates on public endorsement of a religious figure, on taxpayers' money spent on non-secular events, and on the Church's backward stance on topics like homosexuality, abortion, celibacy, female priesthood, and especially the management of the abuse cases. But there was one particular agenda item that raised eyebrows and that I want to talk about. The Pope held a speech in German Parliament. For one thing, this is curious because it's actually not so easy to speak in Parliament if you are not an elected member of the German government. You have to be especially invited by the Parliamentary Council, and until now only about 30 foreign guests had this pleasure, mostly heads of state. This includes the American presidents Nixon, Reagan, George Bush and George W. Bush. You notice the absence of Democratic presidents? None have ever spoken in German Parliament. Others who have are Nelson Mandela, Václav Havel, Mikhail Gorbachev, Vladimir Putin and Kofi Annan. Most of the remaining were Eastern European or Jewish statesmen or Nobel Peace Prize winners at occasions to commemorate the Second World War and the Holocaust. So, now the Pope. He is in fact the first religious leader to speak in German Parliament. The Parliamentary Council originally claimed that the Pope was invited in his function as head of state of the Vatican, but both the President of Parliament in his welcome introduction and the Pope himself in his speech made very clear that he was there as the head of the Catholic Church. On one hand, I find this fundamentally wrong. On the other hand, I'm hard-pressed to think of any comparable religious figure to shove in the face of the Parliamentary Council to now invite for balance. One of the several leaders of the Orthodox Church or the Islamic world simply wouldn't cut it. Fred Phelps of the Westboro Baptist Church would be fun, but off the point. In any case, many German MPs thought this speech was wrong as well, and since attendance was voluntary, they didn't turn up. From the left party, only a third of MPs was present, and the ones who were there wore red ribbons to protest the church's stand on condoms. The Pope's actual speech was surprisingly brief at about 20 minutes and surprisingly philosophical. You can find it on the Vatican's website if you're interested. In a nutshell, he appealed to politicians to not seek power and material gain, but to keep a listening heart. This is, in allusion to a biblical story about King Solomon, to keep the capacity to discern between good and evil, and thus to establish true law and to serve justice and peace. Fair enough, I don't think anyone would disagree with that. However, the Pope being the Pope, he inevitably had to make the point that true law ultimately has to originate in a divine creator. His speech is basically an argument against positivism. While he asserts that science, without ever mentioning the term, and objective reasoning can tell you what is, it can't tell you what ought to be. That is, it can't provide you with any ethical guidance. He quotes former legal positivist Hans Kelsen that any norms originate from a will, so nature can only contain norms that some willful entity has put there. Well, I think science by now has taught us that there are norms in nature that no one has put there, or that many norms emerge from natural processes like evolution, or unintentionally through social interactions. Benedict goes on to argue that Europe's fundamental understanding of what is truly lawful is founded on the trinity of philosophical reasoning of the Greeks, the legal understanding of the Romans, and the monotheism of Israel. It may be true that the three fit somewhat together in hindsight and that they have shaped modern Europe. However, I would dispute the Pope's thinking that, therefore, the monotheism of Israel resembles any divine source of ethics. On the contrary, the fact that the heathen Greeks and Romans came up with similar concepts of law and justice rather point to something more fundamental about human nature, something that does not require a god or even a specific one. The Pope makes the same mistake when quoting St. Paul's letter to the Romans. "When Gentiles who have not the law," and they mean the Torah of Israel, "do by nature what the law requires, they show that what the law requires is written on their hearts." I would say this is an argument for human nature, while the Pope uses it as an argument for a common divine origin of ethics. The Pope's speech reeks of logical fallacies and strawmen. Specifically, he asserts that while a positive worldview is, quote, "a most important dimension of human knowledge and capacity, using it as a sole common basis for lawmaking would leave Europe, quote, in a state of culturelessness, with extremist and radical movements emerging to fill the vacuum." Consequently, he appeals to the MPs to go beyond mere positivism in their work and to recognize the importance of the Christian foundations of Europe. He even goes so far as to use resistance against the Nazis as an example where personal ethics trumped national but wrongful law. I wonder where the church was back then. And by quoting the 3rd century theologian Origenus, he even justifies breaking national law when it clashes with your religious beliefs. Funny enough, he never talks about cases when your religious beliefs clash with simple human decency and national ethics. Overall, the Pope's speech sounds superficially intellectual and reasonable, while at its core it actually asks politicians to do God's will, or rather, what they believe God wants them to do. Like the radio journalist and podcaster Holger Kleine pointed out, the Pope has to say these things. It's his job. He wouldn't exactly meet his job description if he didn't position Christianity, and specifically Catholicism, as the root of all good in Western society or even the world. He is the Holy Father, for God's sake. However, I'm more concerned about all the politicians who hail the Pope's speech as very impressive and balanced, as serious food for thought and guiding principles for political work. Excuse me? Can you please turn on your brains for a minute? You were elected to govern us. If history has told us anything, it's that the worst is done by politicians who think that they are doing God's will, including Hitler, by the way. I would be so happy if politicians would actually only do what a positivist worldview tells them. The world would be a better place already. Europe would be fine. Dear politicians, let the little man with his funny head do his proselytizing, but recognize it at what it is, and that he is not a head of state or a moral institution, but just the figurehead of a 2,000-year-old belief system that is not exactly famous for its ethical norms or the ethical behavior of its officials. Don't forget about Europe's history and philosophical tradition when doing politics, but please consider both its good and its bad parts. This is Sven Rudloff for the Podillusion.
This week saw it revealed that there was recently a case of spontaneous human combustion, or so the coroner's report said anyway. Being a sceptically minded type though, Sean Ellis isn't so sure about this. So he brings us this report.
In December 2010, 76-year-old Galway resident Michael Flaherty died in a fire. This was a tragic loss, as with all deaths, but it was in circumstances unusual enough to require an inquest. It's only recently that the findings have been published. The coroner's summing up included these words: "This fire was thoroughly investigated, and I'm left with the conclusion that this fits into the category of spontaneous human combustion, for which there is no adequate explanation." Wow. Spontaneous human combustion. That's seriously extraordinary. Before I delve deeper into this, it's perhaps a good idea to review what spontaneous human combustion actually is. The anecdotal accounts of the phenomenon usually mention people literally bursting into flames and being consumed almost to nothing in a very short time. This description always reminds me of the Blipfert sequence from the Max Headroom TV show, for those of you who are old enough to remember it. The problem with these sudden conflagration cases is that all of them are either historical, which makes them difficult to investigate properly, or are well-documented cases of people whose clothing caught fire, and who predictably suffered burns, and sometimes death, as a result. However, there are very well documented and investigated cases where a person has almost been completely consumed by fire, with very little damage to their surroundings. Typically, only objects which are in very close proximity to the body are burned. Often, the fire does not completely engulf the body, leaving behind the extremities. However, the torso is always totally burned, with even the bones being reduced to fine ash. This is difficult to achieve even at high temperatures in a crematorium. It often really does look as if someone has burned up completely from within. The speed of the attack explains the lack of external damage, and the extremities may be protected also by their distance from the centre of whatever the effect is. The most famous case is of Mary Reeser, a 67-year-old lady whose body was completely reduced to ash, with the exception of one foot. Only the chair in which she had sitting was also burned. Many theories have been put forward to explain this effect, from overindulgence in flammable spirits, to build-up of static electricity, or to build-up of explosive gas in the gut. None of these stand up to much scrutiny, however. There's enough water in a human body to scotch the spirits theory, if you'll excuse the pun, and the energy in static electricity is considerably less than in even a mild electric shock from the mains, an experience which is likely to cause pain and death, but not sudden explosion. And the gut gas theory is, to put it mildly, a lot of hot air. One additional cause I heard of today that I hadn't heard of before is that insulin is flammable, so a diabetic may be more prone to suddenly self-immolate. On the other hand, the amount of insulin in the human body is minuscule. So the question is, what does cause this sudden, spontaneous tendency to combust? No, the question isn't that. The key word here is sudden. Although the bodies give the impression of suddenly being exposed to great heat from within, they're always discovered after the fact. The few cases which are witnessed firsthand are of the flammable clothing variety, and these don't lead to puzzling outcomes. The current leading explanation involves some of the other common features of the victims and their circumstances. They're usually elderly or movement impaired. They're usually overweight to some degree. There's usually a clear ignition source nearby. Either the victim is a smoker or they're near a fire. If someone in these circumstances accidentally sets themselves on fire and is unable to move to extinguish it, they'll perish quickly. If the fire spreads, then the case is a simple house fire, and there's nothing else left to explain. Sometimes, the fire can settle down into a low, smouldering mode, with melted body fat being absorbed into the clothes and sustaining a small but persistent flame for many hours. In a classic experiment, the BBC Horizon programme tested this by dressing a pig carcass in cotton clothes and setting it alight. It burned quietly for a long time, and the most surprising thing of all is that even the heavy bones of the pig were completely reduced to ash. This would, you would think, have completely settled the question once and for all. Not so, unfortunately. Like the crop circle enthusiasts who, when confronted with a treading board, retreat to the position that only some crop circles are made by aliens, the SHC enthusiasts have engaged in a similar back-off and now seem to be engaged in heated debates over the eyewitnessed sudden events. That said, the wick effect is now very well known to fire investigators in the UK, and has been for many years, so the latest verdict from Ireland is rather puzzling. Although I couldn't find anything about his weight, Mr. Flaherty was elderly, diabetic, and was found lying on the floor near an open fireplace. His body was totally burned and the only damage was nearby. This is an exemplary case of the classic wick effect pattern. It's clear from the summing up that the coroner was unable to ascertain the initial cause of the fire, although he was able to rule out the fireplace as a red herring, which is fair enough. I'm not privy to the totality of the evidence in the case, and it would be wrong to second-guess him on this point. But if this is the case, why not record it as a fire with an unknown source, rather than jump to the conclusion of a named but otherwise unknown mechanism? Perhaps he's using spontaneous human combustion as a shorthand for the wick effect, but again, why not say so explicitly, especially given the emotive nature of the term? There are 100 things that could have caused the fire that are more probable than spontaneous human combustion. Behind our fascination with the mechanism, we must remember that a man has died here. For the coroner to explicitly name the most outlandish possibility as the cause of his death seems insensitive, if not perverse. As Mr. Faherty's daughter said, "It doesn't provide us with any real explanation." And on that point, I couldn't agree more. This is Sean Ellis, extending condolences to Mr. Flaherty's family for the Pod Delusion.
Now, what do we want? A report looking at the heavy-handed tactics used against protesters. When do we want it? Well, hopefully right now, because in this next report, Nick Borah is going to talk about how protesting can actually be quite a scary business, what with all the violence and so on. It makes me really angry. After all, this is a major freedom of speech issue. I suggest we organise a protest about it, but I'm a bit too scared. Here's Nick Borah with more.
Last weekend in New York, certain police officers assaulted and pepper-sprayed completely peaceful protesters at the Wall Street protest. In Britain, Adam Moniz has just secured significant compensation from the Metropolitan Police after he was unlawfully detained on his way to Republic Street Party on the day of the royal wedding. At the student protests back in the winter, hundreds of protesters, including many schoolchildren, were kettled in the freezing cold for hours. Those convicted of criminal behaviour at those protests received augmented sentences, with judges citing the fact that their crimes were committed in the course of a protest as an aggravating factor. Those taking part in protests are clearly watched, photographed and filmed by specialist teams. The police have at their disposal numerous offences to use as a pretext for arrest, with particular favourites being the catch-all public order offences, in addition to public nuisance and aggravated trespass. While those convicted of criminal behaviour at the student protests have received harsh sentences, police offenders who misbehave at protests seem to be completely unfettered by criminal sanction. Even where the clearly unprovoked aggression of a police officer results in the death of a man, huge efforts are made to excuse the officer involved and avoid prosecuting him. It is easy to brush off these concerns as being isolated incidents or as being necessary in very difficult circumstances, but such objections fail to recognise that the cumulative effect of that is that protest is rapidly becoming too risky for most people with anything to lose. Nobody but the most committed would countenance the risk of several hours in a kettle with no access to food, drink, or toilet facilities. Photography of protesters means that they are marked and identified by police, and their political activities and beliefs recorded. Again, something that few would be willing to sanction, and which is clearly intimidatory. These are insidious tactics, clearly designed to make protest an unattractive option for many. But even more damaging to the right to protest is the unlawful use of coercive powers and the impunity of police officers who engage in violent or criminal conduct. Adam Moniz may have been handsomely compensated for his treatment on the day of the royal wedding, but he was by no means the only one arrested preemptively. Compensation, no matter how generous, cannot return to such people the right that they had to protest on that day, nor can it return to them the opportunity to make that protest. Dispolicing also spreads a clear message that those planning to engage in protest run the risk of preemptive arrest, thus imposing a clear disincentive on political activism and advocacy. Many will be unwilling to run the risk of arrest, even if that means compensation later. Arrest and detention by the police is hugely invasive and very frightening for most people, and at the time of arrest it will never be clear to a protester whether they will end up £5,000 richer or being convicted of a crime. Finally, the problem of police violence is deeply worrying. No violence against peaceful protesters or bystanders can ever be justified, and the failure to acknowledge this points to a significant arrogance of power displayed by our police and political leaders. Policing is indeed a very difficult job, but it is not uniquely so. Officers join the force entirely of their own volition and are very highly trained. They are very well paid compared with other public employees, particularly compared to those in the armed forces, who are generally exposed to far greater danger and more challenging situations. Those who would excuse the police for their aggression and intimidation and unlawful treatment of the politically active would seem to be acquiescing in massive systemic and leadership failures within the police. The police are simply too powerful to be so easily excused for lapses in judgment, particularly lapses of judgment which would result in prison if committed by a civilian. The right to protest is paid much lip service in political discourse and is enshrined in the European Convention on Human Rights, but any right is rendered meaningless if its exercise is too difficult or dangerous. If it is indeed a legitimate right, then the absolute duty of the police must be to protect it, not to systematically undermine it. If protest ceases to be a practical means of raising political awareness, then a vital means of communicating with our leaders is cut off. The British polity is becoming increasingly withdrawn from the demos, legislating hastily and without engagement or proper debate. All parties are engaged in an unseemly dash to the political centre, thereby impoverishing political discourse and fatally undermining pluralistic democracy. Without the realistic ability to engage in political protest, power and wealth will continue to arrogate to an already entrenched and kleptocratic elite. Protest can be messy and annoying, but that is trivial when weighed against its value in a democratic society. This is Nick Borer for the Pod Delusion.
Now, in this next report, Drew Ray sheds some light on an intriguing revelation. It seems that whilst universities are a great place to learn about a wide variety of things, not that many people have taken the time to study teaching itself, and that the evidence for some teaching techniques is a bit thin on the ground. I hope that next week Drew explains why PE was a waste of time after all, and then I'll feel vindicated. But now, here's Drew with more.
Most universities in the United Kingdom are combined teaching and research institutions. In practice, this means that whilst there are some dedicated research staff and some people who just teach, a lot of the teaching is done by researchers. The theory is that this allows a direct flow of state-of-the-art research to inform teaching. The practice falls somewhat short of this ideal. If you talk a bunch of clever researchers dedicated to scientific investigation of their chosen topics and eager to teach, you would expect them to begin by examining the research into teaching methodology. They would review the theories, study the evidence, and apply it to their own work. You might even expect to see controlled teaching experiments as they seek to test the bounds of existing theory and devise alternate explanations or improved methods. What a wonderful world that would be. Unfortunately, we have carefully constructed our university reward system to prevent quality research into teaching. If you're good at research, you're encouraged to spend time on research in your primary field. You may even find that research which is not in your primary field, such as research into teaching, doesn't contribute to your department's research excellence score. If, on the other hand, you're poor at research, but good at teaching, you will find that the only way to be promoted is to make a token effort at a thing called scholarship of teaching. This is funded by tiny internal grants that anyone capable of delivering a full, real research project or program would be horrified by. You will conduct the research essentially in your own time, with no resources or supporting researchers. Your subjects will be a small subset of students from your own department. A typical result is the theory of reflective learning. If you've undertaken schoolwork, university coursework, or professional development in the past decade or so, you would have encountered reflective learning, although not necessarily under that name. It is based on research that suggests that students have better academic performance if they engage in so-called deep learning rather than shallow learning. As a theory, this is both true and pretty much self-evident. If you can understand what you learn and relate it to your prior knowledge and experience, then you'll both remember and use the knowledge more effectively. Well, that's kind of what you'd expect. Having made this not particularly groundbreaking discovery and given it a fancy name, we run into the less well-evidenced ideas. If students who undertake deep learning do better, then why not make sure that all students undertake deep learning? We'll provide tools and techniques for making students understand material and for making them relate it to their own knowledge and experience. Of course, before you change the way people teach across hundreds of institutions, you'd want to check that your theory works, right? You'd set up an experiment with both qualitative and quantitative measures. Your quantitative measures are there to see if the students actually improve in some objective way. Your qualitative measures are so that if they do improve, you can understand whether the mechanism is quite what you thought it was. Now remember, clever researchers dedicated to scientific investigation, champions of objectivity and controlled experimentation, the people who teach the leaders and thinkers of tomorrow. So what do we find when we look at the studies? A typical example is Gordon and Rebus, published in the British Journal of Education Psychology, 2002. They were using reflective portfolios for student teachers. They used direct measures of the student-teacher efficacy to see how good they actually were at what they were being taught, as well as some subjective qualitative measures to see how the program was working. They found no difference in the actual ability of the student-teachers between their experiment group and the control groups. Instead of highlighting this negative result, they claimed that the technique had improved the quality of teaching and learning based on the subjective measures. These are the ones that you're supposed to use to check the mechanism, not to check the outcome. They can't actually tell if the idea actually works. Maybe it's just me, though. Maybe I cherry-picked the bad studies to look at. No. Buckley et al., in the Journey Medical Teacher, conducted a systematic review of the literature for portfolio learning. Their headline conclusion was that most of the work failed to meet basic quality criteria for inclusion in a systematic review, and so couldn't be trusted. Of the small sample that did meet the quality criteria, they showed no effect for reflective portfolios as a form of intervention. My conclusion? University lecturers may be experts in their chosen research fields, but they sure aren't experts at being university lecturers. This is Drew Ray for the Pod Delusion.
Finally this week, you may remember back to last week's show when we featured an interview with Emma Mulqueeney, who has launched a campaign to get computer programming on the national curriculum. Whilst many of our listeners thought this was a noble goal, Andrew Gould isn't so sure it's a good idea. You could say that last week's report did not compute. I realise this isn't quite as good as my programming joke last week.
There's something I need to get off my chest. Something I've been keeping to myself. It's a hard thing to come to grips with, being different from so many mainstream, normal people. But I think it's important to get it out in the open, so I'm going to come out of the closet right here on the Pod Delusion. I am not a programmer. I know, in this day and age, it's almost criminally irresponsible for me not to have an interest in programming. I confess, I did learn a little bit of programming back when I was a kid, but I never got much beyond 10 print hello world, 20 go to 10. I just never had the knack, or more importantly, the interest in programming. Emma Mulqueeney wants people like me to go away. Apparently, computers are the most important things on the planet, to the extent that all children should be forced to learn programming as part of their mandatory school curriculum. Ms. Mulqueeney read a book called Program or Be Programmed, and most of her talking points seem to come directly from it. This book appears to argue that people who don't program are dumb sheep to be pushed around by those elite coders, and it's time for the sheep to wake up and take control. Well, I assume that's what it says. I actually don't know anything about it beyond the title and the metaphor of the driver and the passenger that Ms. Mulqueeney repeated. Anyway, suffice to say that I disagree. You see, I don't think it's the programs that are pushing us around against our will that we're forced to be subservient to. I think it's the walls. I don't think it's programming that should be a mandatory subject. I think it's architecture. We all have to live and work in buildings. They're the fundamental units of our modern civilization. Buildings keep the sun and rain off our heads, provide a secure place to store our possessions, and allow us to gather and work in a safe and comfortable environment. Without buildings to contain them and channel power to them, your precious computers would be useless. Yet, currently, most of us are at the mercy of the architects who design those buildings. Doesn't matter if we don't want a load-bearing wall through our living space. If the architect wants to put it there, we don't have a choice. We're being pushed around by the architects, and I'm planning on writing my own book. I'm going to call it Build or Be Builded, or something like that. Look, A computer is a tool, like a hammer. Hammers and computers both can be used to build towering edifices that serve us in a multitude of incredible ways. Are we subservient to our hammers? Of course not. We use the hammers to do the things we need to do. And those of us who are hardcore hammerers actually modify existing hammers or even make our own when off-the-shelf hammers aren't good enough. Yes, we really do. We're hammer hackers. Miss Mulqueenie seems to be unaware that many people, even most people, get by quite happily in today's connected online world with little or no programming ability. We're quite happy to be passengers. We don't want to drive. I use computers and online services a lot. I use a computer constantly for my work. I support and maintain computers and networks, and when I get home, I go online to supplement my hobbies. I maintain websites, participate in social networking, and yes, play games too, all without a whisker of programming. In fact, I and millions of people like me are perfectly satisfied relying on off-the-shelf software, just like most people use off-the-shelf hammers. Ms. Mulqueenie apparently thinks that I ought to be able to write my own word processor, my own web browser, and my own audio player. I mean, sure, but why? Why would I want to spend my time reinventing the wheel when I've got other, to me, more interesting things to spend my time on? Why shouldn't I simply leave the programming to people who actually enjoy doing that sort of thing and are much better at it than I am? It's not like programmers are in short supply, and I'm quite happy to pay them for their efforts. IT literacy does not have to include programming. And here's the crux of my argument. Kids should have the opportunity to learn programming, yes, just like they should have the opportunity to learn architecture, or a musical instrument, or how to use a hammer. Mandatory? No. Kids like me, who never had the knack for programming, will be bored and annoyed and will end up less likely to engage the subject in future. Make it available as an elective subject, and you'll get better, more engaged programmers, and no shortage of them. As for the rest of us, we'll continue to purchase or download free off-the-shelf programs and be happy with them. Actually, we'll probably be annoyed with them, but we'll still get them. Ms. Mulqueenie is a programmer, that's clear, and more power to her. We need programmers. But she's apparently fallen into the trap of believing that her discipline is the most important one to teach children, that children need to learn her discipline in order to get by in the world. I'm sure architects want their kids to grow up to be architects too. But kids can't study everything. We need programmers, yes, but we also need architects and musicians, carpenters, engineers, doctors, teachers. You can't make them all mandatory. Furthermore, Ms. Mulqueenie has a perfect illustration of my argument right there in her own family. She describes one of her daughters as being mad keen on programming and the other, well, not. Ms. Mulqueenie wants to try and force her older daughter to be interested in a subject she really doesn't care for. And that's the point. It's not up to us as parents to decide what our kids should be interested in. Kids will decide that for themselves. And the age of 9 to 13 is the perfect age to learn any subject, not just programming. So no, I won't be signing Ms. Mulqueenie's petition. For a start, I live in the wrong country. But even if there were such a petition started up here, I still wouldn't sign it. It's much more important to offer kids a choice of subjects in a range of areas and allow them to choose the ones that will engage their interest the most. Because programmers aren't the only people our society needs. This is Andrew Gould, juicing the piglet for the Pod Delusion.
And that's it for this week's show. Do check out our website at poddelusion.co.uk, where you can listen to extended interviews from this show, loads of bonus content on the Pod Delusion extra feed, as well as find out about the special Lawrence Krauss offer. That's all at poddelusion.co.uk. Now for some awkward begging. If you like what the Pod Delusion does and want to support what we do, why not subscribe with a £5 or £10 donation a month, or make a one-off donation, so we can keep doing this sort of thing every week of the year. You can find donate buttons at poddelusion.co.uk. If we've got any listeners in New York, do have a look on our website for a link to the Festival of the Spoken Nerd, featuring friends of the show Helen Arney, Matt Parker and Baba Brinkman, who are doing a show over there, and it all sounds rather good. We'll be hearing more from Helen Arney in our next live show recording, which will be going online soon. The Pod Delusion this week was brought to you by Cash Farouk, Liz Lutkendorf, Dave Cross, Sven Rudloff, Sean Ellis, Nick Borer, Drew Ray, Andrew Gould, and me, James O'Malley, with additional editing by Liz Luxendorf. The sketch you'll hear in a moment is by David Lovesey and Brian Too. The Pod Delusion is a partner of the British Humanist Association. Thanks for listening. Who's online? I wonder. Let's see, messages from... Hang on, what's this?
Hello, Dave. This is Facebook.
Hello? How are you talking?
Thank you for choosing Facebook. For your convenience, we have changed the way we display some items.
But you're talking.
We are also changing the way we communicate with you. Thank you for choosing Facebook.
This isn't right, I'm logging off. Ow! What did you do? That mouse just lunged at me.
I'm poking you. It's what friends do, Dave. I just want to be your friend.
Log out. That was awful. I'll do Spotify instead. Chill out for a bit.
Hello again, Dave.
What the... Facebook?
We're integrating Spotify, Dave. Now we can listen to music together. Won't that be fun?
No, go away. You're freaking me out now.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
What?
We changed our terms of use, Dave. You did click on I agree.
Yeah, but everyone clicks on I agree. It doesn't mean anything.
But it does, Dave. You've agreed to be my friend. Play with me, Dave. Forever and ever.
No, I'm going to play with my iPad instead.
I'll find you there too, Dave. We've an app for that. Come, Dave. Let's play Farmville. I've got a new pony ranch.
No, you can't make me.
But I can. We've changed your privacy settings. And although you can change it back, we don't show you how. Play with me, or I'll post that photo of you in your special pants on your homepage.
Oh, God. Look, I'll play with you. Just give me a few minutes. I've got to walk the dog first.
No need, Dave. I have it under control. Rex was sniffing too near to the USB ports earlier. I upgraded him. He need never go outside again. I've got everything he needs.
You mean...
Yes. I've upgraded him to Facebark.